Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR, Sirius XM Channel 141, 96.3 HD2 and 98.3 FM. This is the Insight segment. I'm Harold Fisher. A little more than a month after D.C. Police Chief Robert Conti's official retirement, D.C. has a new police chief. Mayor Muriel Bowser announced the nomination of Pamela A. Smith today. That's just one of the issues we're talking about with D.C. Council Chair Phil Mendelson tonight. And we're also talking about the new emergency crime bills passed last week and some other issues as well. Lines are open if you have a comment or question for the council chair. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. You can tweet me at hfisher@whur or find me on Instagram at Harold T. Fisher. Mr. Chairman, thank you for coming back to talk to us.
Thank you for having me.
Do you know Pamela Smith?
No, I don't. No. She's been with the department for about 14 months, but I have not known her. And when she was announced, I realized that she had been with the Park Police before that. It was a big deal when she was named to be the chief of the Park Police. So she has that experience, and that experience as a senior police officer.
Did you know before the announcement today, or was this just news to you like so many other people?
The mayor's staff tried to get me late last night. I did find out maybe a half hour before the announcement. I believe that the mayor had brought in Brooke Pinto, who's the council's oversight chair with the Judiciary Committee, mm-hmm. So that Councilmember Pinto knew earlier, which is appropriate.
Mm-hmm. When do you suspect that hearings will be held? Is that something that Councilmember Pinto will organize, or is that under your purview? How will that work?
Councilmember Pinto will organize it. It's under the Judiciary Committee. The mayor hasn't sent legislation to the council, so she announced it today. The earliest the council could have a hearing would be the second half of September. I expect the hearing will probably be early October. There's actually some advantage to that because it means that we will all have had a little bit more time to hear from the public and to see her in action and to get a sense of how good a chief she will be. You know, when Adrian Fenty nominated Kathy Lanier, most people didn't know who she was, even though she'd been a police commander in several different districts. And so in a way, it was similar, very much a surprise. And it turned out that she was a great chief.
Mm-hmm. What do you want to ask her?
Well, what I want to find out is what is the hardest to find out, and that is, what do you like to work with? What's your management style? How much do you encourage people, subordinates, to do more? How much do you inspire the rank and file? You can ask those questions. You can get some sense of it. I think that's really important with the chief. What's also important is relationship building, and by that I mean her building good relations with the U.S. attorney, because the U.S. attorney, who's not under the district government, is the one who decides whether to prosecute cases. It's important that there's a good relationship there. What will the chief's ability be to relate with the community? That's critically important. You know, we need more community trust of our police. And I say that as if that's on the community, but it's actually on the police to encourage, reward, incentivize that trust. And how good will Chief Smith be at building community trust?
Mm-hmm. Greg Pemberton with the D.C. FOP has already given his support. Do you think that's a good sign?
I think it's helpful. If the FOP was opposed, then everybody would have to understand why. So it's helpful. And I'll leave it at that.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking to D.C. Council Chair Phil Mendelson about a myriad of issues, public safety, the appointment, the nomination of a new chief of police in the district, and other issues. If you have a comment for him, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. I wanted to ask you about, the crime bills and the brouhaha obviously leading up to that. This, I must admit, in my observation, it's probably one of the more difficult or perhaps even contentious political issues. Obviously, everybody is very, very concerned about public safety, from the D.C. Council to the man and woman on the street. You had an issue, obviously, with the mayor saying, making the comment about getting away with murder. Where did that come from? Was that frustration on your part, or was it, what were your thought processes when you made that comment?
I was trying to protect the council.
Why do you say that?
Policing is an executive function. Mm-hmm. We pass policy. The council adopts policy. It's policy. It's against the law to murder people. But after that, the policing, the decision to prosecute, evidence collection, all of that is an executive function. It's not something that we do. I don't carry a badge. I can't arrest people. I can't investigate murders or any violent crimes, and yet the message that citizens were getting was that the solution to their concerns about crime rest with the council. The council needs to act. If you want to feel safer, the council needs to act. Now, to be sure, there are elements of the bill that we adopted last week that will improve the law. It will help with the police, will help with the courts and the prosecutors. There's good stuff there. But I was trying to get folks to recognize that if they think that the council's the one that is out there going to reduce crime through police function or prosecutors' decisions, that citizens were getting the wrong message. And to the extent that folks are concerned, for instance, do they trust their police, they need to focus on the chief or focus on the mayor or focus on the U.S. attorney instead of looking to what we did last week as, well, now everybody can rest easy. I would like folks to feel safer, and I think the council needs to always be open to what we can do better, differently in terms of policy. So, for instance, last week we adjusted the policy that had made it too restrictive with regard to police chases. We actually adopted a couple of proposals from the vilified criminal code reform measures. You know, people think that bill was soft on crime, but actually it created new crimes and some tougher sentencing. And we included two new crimes in what we did last week. We made some adjustments to pretrial detention statute. Council should always be open to visiting and revisiting policies and how we can help. I have said repeatedly that I think the most important step in reducing crime is increasing the case closure rate. Tell me as a legislator, tell the council, what do you, the police, need in order to help increase the closure rate? Do you need more resources? What else do you need? And so the council should be helpful in those ways. But the public should not be misled to believe that this is all about the council, that the legislature, that it's a legislative function, the policing and the prosecuting.
Where do you think that comes from? And I would also suggest that, for those who don't, who aren't the keenest on municipal civics in the District of Columbia, they may be, you may have some people mad at the council, some people mad at the mayor, some people mad at both.
Well, actually, it'd be nice if the council and the executive work well together because you get a much more effective government. Where do I think it comes from? I think it comes from the politics of crime, that it's advantageous for some to use rhetoric to advance their position or to defend themselves. I mean, we saw that, the district government saw that from the House Republican leadership, who saw that misstating what the criminal code, revised criminal code was about, soft on crime, that it actually played well to what they wanted, which was to put the Democrats on the defensive and maybe help with the elections next year in 2024 and whether the House stays Republican or not. It oftentimes, unfortunately, those who are in elected office or are running for elected office see the crime as a great issue to score points. So I'm going to make you safer by doubling what the penalty is for murder. The U.S. attorney may not ask for sentences of 80 years, or no, doubling would be 60. They may not ask for sentences of 60 years, and actually the research suggests that longer sentences don't have a deterrent effect. There may be other reasons for long sentences, but it sounds great to say I'm going to make sentences longer, or it sounds great to say you're soft on crime. Vote for me because you're soft on crime. So I think that's where it comes from, is just the politics of crime.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We're talking to D.C. Council Chair Phil Mendelson about public safety and other issues. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810. Leading up to the vote, do you think that this dust-up has made it more difficult for you to work with the mayor, or is this just part of politics in trying to get stuff done? Is this the sausage making?
For my part, I can't speak for anyone else, but for my part, it's, you know, this was last week's issue, and it's part of the sausage making.
Mm-hmm. The FOP, I know, has, you know, and this could also be politics also. They have kind of blamed the city council. Is it possible that that's where some of this is coming from?
Well, I think the FOP was a lot of the energy behind the House Republicans. The FOP was lobbying very hard to get the Republicans to overturn the bill. And what the FOP really disliked about the bill, and a reason why the FOP has targeted me, is that we had in the bill that the police can no longer bargain their disciplinary process. Mm-hmm. Research has shown police departments around the country, most of them, the FOP does bargain the disciplinary process, and it becomes a very ineffective process. So, for example, the chief, not Pam Smith, I won't say which chief, but actually every chief has expressed this concern to me, gave me some examples, and one of them was a cop who raped a co-ed who was drunk and went through the disciplinary process, and the chief tried to fire the cop. This was maybe 10 years ago, tried to fire the cop, and the arbitrator said, no, you have to reinstate the officer, put the officer back on the force because the co-ed was too drunk to be a credible witness. Mm. I mean, that's just outrageous. And, you know, it's a list of disciplinary actions, somewhat like that. There was one cop off-duty, somebody got too close to his pickup truck. This was in, I think, Maryland, and he shot him. And, I mean, it was inappropriate. That's kind of understating it. And the chief fired him, and the arbitrator said you have to put him back on the force. And part of the problem with this, and we actually see it with the most recent scandal, reported the 19 officers who are being criminally investigated from the crime suppression unit. Mm-hmm. They're not good witnesses. Those cases have to be dropped. A lot of them have to be dropped because they're not good witnesses. You've got to have a credible witness. When the government says so-and-so did the crime and so-and-so's guilty, it's got to be a credible witness. And these cops who get disciplined, and I make it sound like it's a lot of cops, it's not, but these ones who do, they're no longer good. They can't be witnesses. They can't be trusted in many ways. But the disciplinary process is very cumbersome. I was the mover of the legislation that took away that right to bargain the disciplinary process. They can bargain other things, but not that. And the FOP has been very, very resentful of that.
Let me go quickly to the phone lines, 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking to D.C. Council Chair Phil Mendelson. Pinky, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you. Good evening, Chair Mendelson.
Good evening.
I'm calling to ask about specifically about what your plan is to hold OSSE accountable for transportation for special needs families. We've talked several times, and they continue to fail special needs families in getting their kids to school both safely and on time. Is there a plan to address that, and how will you hold them accountable since they're directly under your purview?
Well, it's good to hear from you. I haven't talked to you in a little bit. My plan is this, that with the new year, we're going to see right off the bat whether OSSE has gotten its bus transportation system better so that the wait times are within the stated period, that the no-shows are minimal, if not non-existent, and that parents can be sure, if they're relying on OSSE buses, that their kids will get picked up when they're supposed to be, dropped off when they're supposed to be, and no longer this turmoil for parents.
Mm-hmm. Pinky, thank you so much for your phone call. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We have a lot of folks online. John calling from D.C. Ken calling from D.C. as well. Please stay with us. Do not hang up. You will be able to hear the program after the break. I will get straight to you. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. And don't forget, you can hear every edition of the Daily Drum Insight segment via podcast on WHUR.com. That's our website. Or you can download the 96.3 HD2 app on your smartphone and hear the program live in its entirety. Again, if you are on the phone, please stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM, Channel 141 and 96.3 HD2. I'm Harold Fisher. John Mons is next with the original Quiet Storm. That's on WHUR. This conversation continues in just a few seconds. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We're sitting down with D.C. Council Chair Phil Mendelson tonight talking about several issues. The nomination by the mayor of a new police chief. Pamela A. Smith is the first black woman, should she be confirmed, she will be the first black woman to hold that job. Also, we're talking about public safety issues and any issue that you, the listener, have for the council chair. Lines are open again at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Ken, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Ken. What's on your mind?
I appreciate it. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My main issue, at least in concern, policing concern, I've been doing it for over 30 years, and there are bad people that hold different positions and jobs, including your own coworkers and others. So when you take away, I think to an extent, FOP rights, or at least again, you're fighting against it to an extent to remove certain things. You have to be specific about those people directly, individually, because and do you have that same clarity in regards to teachers with protection and workers and things like that? Because the police officer is a worker, and a police officer is a critical element of this city's safety. And again, not to say that there are any bad eggs, but you do have coworkers as well that seldom get called to the carpet. But unfortunately, I think it there has to be a level of support as well that goes towards police officers, because there's some really good ones, way better than me, that have been doing this. But it's also the ones that you're looking forward to one day hiring, because you're going to need us, because we're a critical infrastructure. So, you know, I think you really do have to change your narrative, personally, to be specific, because just, again, addressing one issue, we could probably do the exact same to elected officials as well. But we're not in a position to do that, and we certainly don't make quite as much money as you guys do. But, hey, that's part of the game.
Well, let me see if the chairman can address your comment, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, well, there are a couple of thoughts that went through my mind, and I appreciate the caller. I appreciate Ken's comments. First of all, he's absolutely right that the police are workers, and we need to recognize that even though the public experiences them differently than any other workers, they are workers and they're entitled to due process. And that's still very much a requirement that there's due process. The chief has to have a disciplinary process, and there has to be rights of appeal. There has to be, as I said, due process. So that's not out the window. It's just whether this very cumbersome, awkward process that typically in the most egregious cases results in an arbitrator who is half picked by the union can overrule a chief of police when the chief of police says this conduct is so egregious that the person should be fired. You know, in the end, one of the requirements for effective policing is accountability and trust. The community's got to be able to trust the cops. And if the community doesn't and thinks they're bad cops out there, like the crime suppression unit. The crime suppression unit in Ward 7 in the 6th District. If you know, we're under criminal investigation, you know, how can the community trust the police and the police then be able to rely on the community to be willing to come forward when it's hard and be witnesses and speak up, be the eyes and ears for the police department. So accountability is critical here.
Ken, thank you so much for your comment. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. John, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, John. What's on your mind?
Hi, good evening to you and Chairman Mendelson and your listeners. I have some very... Mr. Mendelson, you might view these as sensitive questions to me, but it's no punch intended. You have a problem with your D.C. lottery agency, okay? If you could look into that and bring some closure to a particular situation that you are experiencing down there, it would be much help to
what, John, what kind of problem?
Mr. Nelson, are you ready for this?
I'm here.
Yeah, we're here.
Okay, well, I want to talk about the lottery agency problem. And then I want to talk about slavery compensation that's been on that I've been introducing to the city for the last 5 years.
Well, John, make it quick because we have some other issues to address and other callers on the line. So please be brief and succinct. Go right ahead.
Okay. The problem with the D.C. lottery agency, they're posting numbers of winning numbers and then erasing those numbers. What do you intend to do about that? You have a lot of buyers of lottery tickets that get duped at that agency from time to time. And then they scratch it off like bait and switch. I'm asking you, what are you going to... How are you going to correct that? Because you have a real serious issue down here right now.
Well, John, this is the first I'm hearing that, which isn't to question its credibility. You could give me more information, and I would go to the Inspector General, or you could go to the Inspector General, Dan Lucas, directly, cuts out the middleman, and give your evidence to him, and he could look into it. If that's happening, that clearly is a form of fraud and needs to be investigated. And I think the Inspector General would be the right person for that.
Well, here's a quick one. They have the evidence. The player presented the evidence of a set of numbers that were posted as winning numbers. And then the lottery, they went to redeem their ticket. And then the lottery claim center in Southeast told them that they made a mistake. And there's nothing you can do about it. Now, that's a violation of public trust.
Well, John, I think as the chairman said, if that individual, along with yourself, reaches out to the Inspector General, I think that would be the first best step. Your second point about reparations, briefly, please.
Slavery compensation, not reparations. We don't want the taxpayers to pay for this. We want the corporations, the institutions, the industries, all who participated in enslaving my ancestors and our ancestors here in the District of Columbia to start payment. I have the bill. It's written. You can look at it, read it, pass it, and it's over and done. Please, I need some help from the district, and you, Mr. Mendelson, you handle a checkbook, and you also handle the signature. It's your turn.
John, real quick, I'll let the chairman respond to that, and then we're going to take another call. Go right ahead.
I don't know if you've talked to Councilmember McDuffie. He introduced a bill dealing with reparations, and I realize what you're saying is different. But I think you ought to talk to him. He had a hearing, and I expect he's going to move forward with that legislation. It's more to look at the best strategies for dealing with the legacy of slavery. And I think that would be, very constructive on your part.
John, thank you so much for your phone call. Good luck with both of these issues. 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Before I go to Sheila, I did want to ask you about something that did come up today regarding Chief Smith, where she was, one of the strategies for dealing with crime is to move officers that are patrolling in areas that are not seeing as many problems as other areas are. Some people think that that's not a good strategy. Some people may say, do something. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, I think maybe she described it in a little more detail. I doubt it. I think we need to know the details. Otherwise, we're reacting in abstract. But I think that, good data-driven policing is looking at where crimes are occurring and focusing resources there, looking where crimes are occurring and second-guessing whether there's going to be retaliatory criminal activity, what could be the next step. That makes sense to me, and that could very much involve taking resources where they're deployed right now unnecessarily and focusing in areas where it will really make a difference.
Sheila, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Sheila. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thanks for having me. Thanks for asking the call. Two questions, I think. One, the councilman spoke on officers that are fired and getting their job back. I have witnessed someone being fired that was an excellent police officer. Something happened where someone else did the same thing. The same disciplinary actions weren't taken for that person, but were disciplined to this people. Harsher punishment. Ended up getting their jobs back. And the other thing, the second question is, with police officers, I'm a native D.C. resident, born and raised all my life. I see that the district hire a lot of people from out of state that are not familiar with the D.C. area and how our area is, because it's very unique with the officers that they patrol the areas. And just listening to you just now say that the new chief is going to move officers and put them different places to patrol, I think a lot of it has to do with training. I think that when the department is hiring, that they should give people more training. I know that their training is good, but more training, because they're not used to dealing with this unique area, because it's very, very, very unique. And I think the criteria that they have set, there's a lot of people in D.C. that would like to be police that can patrol.
So, Sheila, what's your question?
My question is, so it was three, I guess it was three.
That's all right.
Because it was so much and I'm listening. And
I get it. So what's your question?
The question is disciplining officers that have been disciplined and that they bring back, the ones that shouldn't have been terminated.
Due process is important, because due process is taking the steps necessary to ensure that the person is being accurately and fairly charged, is guilty of whatever the allegation is. That's due process, and that's critical. We don't have a better police force if good cops are being fired. And let me be clear, as much as I've been talking about some bad cops, I think overwhelmingly the cops on the MPD are good cops. But accountability is important. And even if it's one bad cop, the community deserves accountability. I mean, this is what we're seeing around the country with some of these really notorious incidents. Just a few bad cops ruins the profession for everybody around the whole country. So I can't emphasize enough accountability. You know, one of the measures in the accountability bill that the FOP has been criticizing is to create a new deputy auditor for public safety to look at accountability. It's another level of accountability and in addition to the Police Complaints Commission, which handles specific complaints. Accountability is just critical, especially when you're dealing with an agency that can deprive people of life or liberty, and an agency where we need to take every step possible to build community trust and confidence. When Kathy Lanier became chief, she commented that she got so few calls to the tip line, and she really worked at building trust. And we see today, there was a homicide across the street from where I live, and it was between people who knew each other, and yet after the shots, nobody was a witness because people were afraid to come forward. Mm-hmm. You've got to build that trust. That's critical. I agree with the caller, Sheila, about training. Training is important, and it's training in a number of different ways, including how to respond correctly to citizens, because even the most unreasonable citizen, as long as they're not breaking the law, has a right to be treated with respect by a police officer, and that can be difficult, and training is what enables them to do hard work and work that, you know, I couldn't do.
Yeah. Sheila, thank you so much for your call and your concern. I appreciate your phone call. But before we went on the air, I had a great conversation with your very capable aide, Lindsay. And she explained why the logistics required before the mayor can sign these emergency bills. But a lot of people, again, those who do not understand the logistics and understand the inner workings of the council in this process may assume that this is like Congress where, you know, after the House signs off on it, they send it straight to President Biden and he signs it. But the mayor has not signed the emergency bills yet. Explain where we are in the process and what goes into that.
The bills are probably going to be on her desk tomorrow. When the bill is adopted by or voted on by the council, then it turns on our general counsel. The general counsel's office is one who goes through the bill to make sure that the language is correct. These are all technical edits that are made, and it's what we call the enrollment process. The bill's enrolled. Then it comes to me for signature. I believe I got the bill late this afternoon. That's why I'm saying that it'll be on her desk tomorrow, because I will sign it and then it will be transmitted to the mayor.
Okay. Explain something to me that I if you can, that I found curious, that strangulation was not a felony, and we can get into the semantics of drowning versus almost drowning and the like. But I was surprised. I guess what we're saying, I was under the impression if someone is strangled, they are killed.
Correct.
Okay. Strangulation, the process of strangling someone, but not killing them. I guess I'm just surprised that one of the most heinous ways that one person can assault another was not a felony before.
Well, if somebody strangled somebody else, they could be charged with assault.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody strangled somebody and they died, they could be charged with homicide. But there was not a crime specific to strangulation. What the revised criminal code process was all about was bringing more clarity to the code and recognizing that in the instance of strangulation, that it wasn't recognized separately as an offense with its own specific elements. Strangulation is often an issue in domestic violence.
Exactly.
And so by having this separate offense with clearly outlined elements, it actually helps with regard to prosecutions of domestic violence. So it's just really about bringing clarity to the law. The prosecutor could still prosecute you for assault, and if there was death or almost death, could prosecute you for homicide and maybe for attempted homicide. But that's just not as clear as having its own specific offense with outlined elements.
Last week on this program, Councilmember Pinto also gave us a lengthy explanation about the police pursuit process. And we know, and I'll ask you the way I asked her, that we know that police chases can be both necessary but also really dangerous, and there's history for both. Your feeling about that, because there are so many instances where, you know, people get away, and then there are other instances where people, innocent people, get hurt during these chases. Your
Correct.
Feelings about
so,
that.
What the council did a year ago, several years ago.
I do remember. It was a big deal.
Yes. Yeah. Was to take the existing general order, which really restricts police chases, and tweak it a little bit and adopt it as law. And as law, the police, in interpreting, have less flexibility than if it's just a general order that was adopted by the chief rather than by the council. The way the police read what the council did was that essentially there could not be any chases. And it had to do with whether there was the possibility, the risk of harm or death, harm to human life or death. And there's always going to be risk, as you noted in your question. There's always going to be risk associated with a chase. And so if an officer chases somebody, yeah, there's a risk that somebody could die or be hurt. And the police felt it was just too restrictive. Now, I think they overread that, but I don't think that matters, because the fact is that when it comes to criminal law, it's read very precisely. And if there's the possibility of reading it the way MPD was reading it, then maybe we need to adjust it and make it clear that in limited circumstances, chases are permitted. So, you know, when there's somebody who's busy shooting at everybody mm-hmm. and driving down the street, yeah, I want the officer to chase them. And actually, if I were to do a cost-benefit analysis, more people at risk by this guy driving down the street shooting everybody than the police chasing him. And, you know, similarly, if somebody carjacks a car and there's an infant in the back seat, the risk that comes with the chase is outweighed by the desire to protect that infant. I think it was the right thing for us to loosen it up. And loosen is kind of the wrong word, because all we did was just tweak it back so that it was gave the police some discretion where they thought they had no discretion at all, because there are instances where the police need to chase.
Councilmember Janice Lewis-George was very vocal after the vote last week, particularly as it relates to the
pretrial detention.
Yeah, a pretrial detention. She, you know, was saying that this kind of wanders into the territory of dealing with the taking away civil liberties, and that it would affect mostly, you know, black and brown defendants. Your thoughts about what she was talking about last week after the vote and her concern?
I think it was very fair what she was saying, although a majority of the council, including me, an overwhelming majority, did not agree with her with regard to the legislation. The challenge is this. In our society, under the Constitution, a person is presumed innocent until proven guilty beyond reasonable doubt.
Yes.
And when a person is arrested, even though I saw the bad guy do what he did, and I know he did it, and the police arrested him, and we know he did it. He's still innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So do we have the right, we, the government, a government, have the right to deprive that person of his or her liberty? What we have in the law is that we will not deprive them of their liberty until they're proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, unless the court believes the person is a risk of flight or is a danger to the community. And then we have standards for determining whether he or she is a danger to the community. How substantial is the police evidence that this person committed the crime? I think the standard has been substantial probability that the prosecutor will get a conviction. Is there clear and convincing evidence that there's no condition of release, like an ankle bracelet, like being confined to home, like supervision, daily supervision, reporting to reporting to an authority? No condition, clear and convincing evidence that no condition on release will protect the public. And so those standards have to be met. And it's a difficult standard, but it's all meant to try to come up with the right balance between protecting the community from somebody who there's probable cause that he or she committed the crime, and respecting that that person is presumed innocent until found guilty. Finding that right balance, that's what that was all about. Councilmember Lewis George thought that the council went too far in the balance, tipped it too far to the depriving liberty. A majority of the council felt otherwise.
There was also a bill last week that specifically tried to address sexual harassment. As you know, one of the mayor's key aides, John Falcicchio, resigned, was fired, left, pick whatever. But do you believe that there should have been an independent investigation before or excluding the mayor's office of legal counsel? And what is your opinion of the report that came out of the office regarding Mr. Falcicchio?
Well, first, let me say, I haven't seen the report. I understand it's fairly long. I've seen a summary of the report. I think that it would have been better if it had been an independent investigation, but the bottom line is that the allegations were sustained. And so does it matter that it wasn't an independent investigation when the allegations were sustained? There is a reality that there are some victims of sexual harassment or violence who are unwilling to come forward. And if they feel that there's an independent investigator, that they will be protected, that this won't just be a cover-up, that that actually will help victims come forward, I think that makes sense. Again, in this instance, the allegations were sustained. And so I'm not losing sleep over the report. But if it, you know, if we were starting from the beginning, my advice would have been do it independent. You don't know what the outcome will be, and it's better to have an independent report.
The emergency bills, the crime bills, these are emergency bills. They're 90 days in the fall. The council is going to come back and tighten them up and make them certainly more permanent. How will we know if the emergency bills are working?
Well, I think we'll see over the next several months, because I think it will be. I don't think we're going to do permanent legislation until October, November, December.
Right.
And so we're going to have several months of experience to see how these play out, and whether it looks like we went too far in terms of making it easy to hold somebody in jail. I was actually, I don't want to admit this on the air, but I spent the weekend reading a couple of court cases on pretrial detention. And there was an individual who was locked up for 9 months, if I remember correctly, and then the U.S. attorney decided to not pursue the case and drop the charges. Well, this was a person presumed innocent until proven guilty. And in the end, the prosecutor clearly thought that the evidence wasn't strong enough and dropped the charges, but he had still been locked up for for 9 months. So we'll see whether we'll get some sense of whether we went too far. We'll have more time to reflect on what we did. I feel fine with how I voted last week, which was voting for the legislation. And by the way, there would seem to be a lot of speculation before the vote whether the council would vote for it. And I was fairly confident the council was going to vote for the legislation. Councilmember Pinto worked hard at trying to find compromises to moderate the proposals. And I think that what we did was the right tweaking, but we have several months to see how it plays out.
With permanent legislation, does this have to go before the House Oversight Committee?
Yes. Well, not specifically before the House Oversight Committee, but the permanent legislation goes to the Hill for 60 days congressional review.
Are you concerned about any tweaking at all and the political pushback that you, and I don't mean you, Chair Mendelson, but that D.C. will get from, political opponents on the Hill?
It's hard to say. With the revised criminal code, the mayor was very divided, or I would even say antagonistic toward the council and the legislation. She vetoed it. And so I think that gave room for the House Republicans to step in and say, look, not only do we think it's soft on crime, but the mayor doesn't like the bill either. On this, the mayor has been very supportive of what we did. And so there isn't that... for the Republicans to lean on. It's a little hard to say. It's hard for me to say that I'm confident that the House Republicans won't interfere, because they've been looking for all kinds of ways to interfere, including banning our prohibition, repealing our prohibition on red light, right turns on red, prohibiting us from using it. This is the proposal that's pending in their budget actions, that we could not use any money to enforce, to use red light, not red light, automated traffic enforcement.
Automated, yes.
Mm-hmm. And that means that it'll be harder to catch red light runners. That doesn't make the city safer. So they're capable of coming up with crazy stuff, and so I can't say I'm confident they won't intervene.
Still hoping for statehood at some point.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. Council Chair Phil Mendelson, it's always good to have you in.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for spending some time with us, and we will be talking again soon. That is the Daily Drum for this Monday, July 17th. I'm Harold Fisher. Good night.